Look, it's Friday, May 8th. We've got a White House trying to play it cool in the Middle East, while the domestic economy feels like a fever dream. Following up on yesterday's look at the AI arms race, we're seeing a massive power shift in how compute is managed. Plus, the Kentucky Derby has a historic winner, but the sport itself is having a bit of an identity crisis. Here's what's actually happening. The White House is currently pushing a strategy of de-escalation in the Middle East. The administration is reportedly leaning on economic pressure to force compliance regarding nuclear ambitions and the Strait of Hormuz, though there's a risk of escalation if the diplomatic needle doesn't move. Despite some rumors, any potential memorandum of understanding would only be a precursor to actual negotiations, not a finished deal. Here's the thing. The timing isn't accidental. The White House is trying to juggle geopolitical stability with the need to keep oil prices down heading into an election year. It's a classic don't rock the boat move, but the boat is currently in the middle of a literal blockade. In Iran itself, the situation is volatile. There is significant speculation that the leadership is facing internal instability following recent regional tensions. This has led to a state of uncertainty, which usually leads to one of two things. A moderate faction steps up to talk to the U.S., or the economy, already hammered by disrupted oil sales, finally collapses enough to trigger a popular uprising. What's interesting here is the shift in how this is being handled. We aren't talking about Iraq-style nation-building. The strategy now appears to be focused on intelligence and supporting internal opposition. It's cleaner for the U.S., sure, but it leaves the Iranian people in a hell of a position. Meanwhile, the Strait of Hormuz, which used to be Iran's ultimate ace in the hole for oil control, doesn't carry the same weight it used to. Between U.S. domestic production and alternative sources, the world just isn't as desperate for Middle Eastern crude as it was in the 70s. On the economic front, things are weirdly optimistic, but also incredibly volatile. Global stocks are hitting record highs on hopes that these conflicts will end. But the next few months look like a roller coaster. We're seeing a jobless recovery paired with some serious inflationary heat. The Fed is stuck jawboning, basically just talking a big game to manage expectations because they can't actually do much else without breaking the economy. The real story in the markets, though, is the AI burn. Big tech firms like Amazon, Meta, and Microsoft are pouring so much cash into AI infrastructure that their cash flows are hitting 10-year lows. They are betting the farm on the long term, even if it means negative free cash flow for years. It's a massive gamble. While the AI boom is creating a productivity jump, some are already calling the chip stock rally a bubble. The smart move being whispered in the halls of finance? Take your profits from the high-priced chip makers and move them into banks or other businesses that will use AI to cut jobs and boost margins. It's cold, but that's the play. In the political world, Senator Marco Rubio is having what people are calling a moment. After a strong performance at the White House podium, there's talk of a 2028 presidential run. He's leaning into a message of American optimism, which is a nice change of pace from the usual doom scrolling. But he has a major problem. He doesn't have a killer base. In today's GOP, if you don't have the fervent backing of the MAGA core, you're basically auditioning for a role that's already been cast. J.D. Vance is right there with him in the successor lane, but he's carrying the baggage of Trump's various policy reversals. The Republican Party is currently in a Game of Thrones-style struggle to see who inherits the crown. You've got Ron DeSantis trying to rehabilitate his image through, of all things, sports commentary, and Tucker Carlson looming as a rhetorical threat who could redefine America first on his own terms. It's a scramble for the throne, but Trump is still very much in the room. We saw that clearly in the Indiana primaries. Trump-endorsed candidates just knocked off incumbents who dared to oppose his redistricting efforts. This is the new reality. Loyalty to Trump is the only currency that matters in a primary, even if it makes you radioactive to swing voters in a general election. And it's not just about personalities, it's about the plumbing of democracy. In states like Tennessee, we're seeing partisan gerrymandering that splits majority black districts, effectively gutting the Voting Rights Act after the Supreme Court weakened it. They're redrawing maps and shifting filing deadlines to favor the party in power. It's a race to the bottom that's making moderate voices in Congress an endangered species. While we're on the subject of power and control, we need to talk about James Dolan and Madison Square Garden. MSG is using pervasive facial recognition technology, but not for security in the way they claim. They're using it to identify and kick out lawyers and journalists who have criticized Dolan. It's a private entity using high-tech surveillance to create a chilling effect on free speech in what is supposed to be a civic space. It's a small-scale version of what Edward Snowden warned us about with government programs like PRISM. The cost of tracking people has plummeted, and the legal protections haven't caught up. We're building the architecture of oppression and just hoping the people in charge are nice. Spoilers, they usually aren't. Then there's the Muskism of it all. This isn't your grandfather's libertarianism. Elon Musk represents a shift towards state symbiosis, where private actors don't want to get rid of the government, they want to vassalize it. Look at SpaceX and Starlink. They provide sovereignty as a service to states that can't build their own tech. The goal isn't to follow the rules, it's to build the infrastructure so that you are the rules. Even the Mars Project, which sounds like a sci-fi fantasy, is a political tool. It gives Musk leverage over investors and governments today. If you control the tech that the military and the telecommunications industry rely on, you don't need to win an election to have power. It's an engineering-driven approach to society that views democratic debate as bad programming to be optimized away. Finally, looking abroad, Russia's Victory Day parade looked a little thin this year. No heavy military hardware and lots of communication disruptions. Why? Because the Kremlin is genuinely terrified of Ukrainian drone attacks. The war in Ukraine has now lasted longer than the Soviet struggle against the Nazis in World War II, and Ukraine has proven it can strike deep inside Russian territory. The special military operation has turned into a permanent state of anxiety for Moscow. And on a lighter, or maybe weirder note, a recent poll found that a majority of Americans believe the average adult could physically beat Donald Trump in a fight. However, a majority of Republicans polled believe Trump would beat them. Make of that what you will regarding the current state of political idol worship in this country. So, while the geopolitical board is shifting, the tech world is having its own move fast and break things moment. The big news in AI this week is a massive hardware play that's rewriting the power dynamics of the industry. Elon Musk's xAI has entered a partnership with Anthropic to provide the AI lab with a massive injection of compute capacity. Here are the facts. Anthropic is gaining access to xAI's Colossus data center. If you aren't a hardware nerd, here's why that matters. That facility houses hundreds of thousands of NVIDIA GPUs. To put that in perspective, the influx of power is so immediate that Anthropic has already doubled the rate limits for its coding tools and boosted limits for its high-end models. This is part of a larger structural shift for Musk. According to recent reporting, Musk is pivoting from trying to win the model wars to becoming a primary provider of compute for the industry. By leveraging his infrastructure, Musk is positioning himself as a key player for frontier labs who are perpetually starved for chips. Look, this is a deal with the devil moment for Anthropic, but it's a smart one. They've been hamstrung by compute limits that made using their models feel like trying to run a Ferrari on a lawnmower engine. Musk, meanwhile, gets to step away from the pressure of a lagging model and instead become the landlord for the entire neighborhood. It's a cynical, brilliant pivot. While that deal was coming together, Anthropic also held a Code with Claude event to show off how they're actually using those chips. They're moving away from vibe coding towards something they call agentic engineering. They introduced a feature called Dreaming, where agents consolidate memory and extract patterns from past interactions while they aren't active. They also rolled out Outcomes, a quality control system where a secondary agent scores the output of the first against the rubric. On the other side of the fence, OpenAI is firing back with a new GPT model. The reports show this is a direct challenge to Anthropic's latest releases, specifically focusing on efficiency and agentic tasks. Basically, AI that can go do a multi-step job rather than just answering a question. But it's not all forward progress. Anthropic's latest Opus release actually showed a rare performance regression, proving that model development isn't a straight line up. And then there's the latest Grok model. Reports indicate it is currently struggling with instability, suggesting Musk's own models are having a hard time keeping up with the demands of these complex workflows. The reason everyone is obsessed with these agent workflows is that the current business model for AI is frankly shitty. Selling individual tokens, fractions of words, is a race to the bottom. Companies are realizing they can't survive on $20 subscriptions when their compute costs are variable and sky-high. The pivot we're seeing now is toward everything apps and bundled services. They want to sell you a solution or a worker, not a chat box. Technologically, we might be on the verge of a breakthrough that makes this cheaper. There's a new architectural shift being discussed, called sub-quadratic attention. In plain English, current AI models get exponentially more expensive and slower the more information you give them. Sub-quadratic models scale more linearly. This matters because it solves the context window problem. Right now, if you give an AI a massive document, it starts to get stupid or forget the beginning as it reaches the end. This new architecture has been demonstrated to maintain precision across massive token counts. That's the difference between an AI that can read a chapter of a book and one that can remember every line of code in a massive corporate database without breaking a sweat. Finally, Google is making a play for your desktop. They're launching a Gemini app for Mac that aims to provide local file access, but there's a massive gap between what these tools can do and what people are actually doing. Even with Microsoft's Copilot integrated into everything, most users find the activation process so convoluted that they're sticking to Excel and PowerPoint the old-fashioned way. The industry is currently in what experts are calling an adolescent phase. It's awkward, it's expensive, and nobody is quite sure how to behave. The advice for navigating it? Treat the AI like a new intern. Give it a clear task, explain why you're doing it, and tell it what success looks like. If it screws up, don't just close the tab. Tell it exactly why it failed. Think of it as tuition for a better result next time. We're moving out of the era of magic and into the era of management. Now, if you want to talk about a different kind of high-stakes management, we have to look at what happened at Churchill Downs this past weekend. Mage won the Kentucky Derby this weekend. It's a massive milestone for the sport, but the win is already sparking a debate about whether this horse is actually a dominant force or just the beneficiary of a perfect setup. While the Derby was a spectacle, the speed figures were relatively low. Some analysts are pointing out that the win came down to late-season development and a favorable pace, rather than raw brilliance. There's a real sense that this success might not travel. Because of the running style, there are expectations of a struggle in upcoming races like the Belmont or the Travers, where the pace is usually much faster. But the bigger story here isn't just the horse, it's the math. Trainers are increasingly refusing to run their horses on short rest. We're seeing a significant drop in starts per horse across the industry. The winning team has already decided to skip the Preakness Stakes to target the Belmont instead. This is becoming a pattern. Healthy Derby winners skipping the second leg of the Triple Crown because the two-week turnaround doesn't fit modern training schedules. This creates a massive identity crisis for the Triple Crown. According to reports from Twin Spires and industry analysts, we are seeing a fundamental shift where the Derby is the only goal, and the Preakness is becoming a B-tier race for horses that weren't good enough for the first Saturday in May. It's a classic fight between historical tradition and the reality of equine welfare. And the money usually follows the welfare these days. Speaking of money, the way people are betting is changing too. There was a lot of talk this weekend about computer money. Sharp bettors are now looking at late odds drops in pick threes and doubles as a signal that algorithmic bettors are moving in. If you saw the odds tank right before the gates opened, that's the computer guys at work. It's creating a divide between the casual fan and the quants, who are treating the mounting yard like a high-frequency trading floor. Even at Churchill Downs, the execution was a bit of a mixed bag. While the high-end hospitality was fine, the feedback on the ground was that the lower-tier concession areas were a mess. Ran out of food, parking was a nightmare. It's a shitty look for a venue that brings in that much revenue to fumble the basics for the fans and the cheap seats. To keep those fans coming back, Twin Spires is aggressively expanding its handicapping contests. They're trying to build a tournament ecosystem with lower buy-ins to act as a funnel, hoping to turn casual bettors into serious players who might eventually qualify for the National Horse Players Championship. They're basically trying to gamify the decline in actual racing. If the horses aren't going to run as often, the tracks have to find a way to make the betting itself the main event. Horse racing isn't the only sport dealing with a shift in how the business is actually run. The NFL is getting even more comfortable in the broadcast booth. The NFL is effectively moving into the house at ESPN. Disney's latest financial reports show their sports business is pulling in massive revenue, but seeing operating profits dip, mostly because the cost of broadcast rights is getting out of hand. To manage this, the NFL has taken a 10% equity stake in ESPN, while ESPN is taking over the NFL Network and Red Zone. It's a level of vertical integration that would make Ted Turner proud. By swapping equity for content, the league and the network are making it almost impossible for them to ever break up. It also gives the NFL a massive seat at the table when it's time to negotiate the next Monday Night Football contract. Speaking of the NFL, it looks like we're going to avoid the chaos of replacement refs. The league is making progress on a new collective bargaining agreement with its officials. This is the definition of boring news is good news, because nobody wants to spend their Sunday afternoon watching a secondary school teacher try to figure out what a catch is. Over in the gambling world, there's a shakeup at the top. FanDuel CEO Amy Howe is stepping down. She was the only female CEO of a major gaming company, and her exit comes as FanDuel's parent company struggles with a sliding stock price. It's not just them, though. The entire sports betting sector is catching a cold right now as the market realizes that fan engagement doesn't always translate to a sustainable stock price. The WNBA is continuing its aggressive expansion, officially heading north with the Toronto franchise. The league is betting on coach Sandy Brondello to build a culture from scratch, led by a backcourt of Brittany Sykes and Marina Mabry. But the real story is how the league is leaning into the NBA model of star-driven growth. Every single Indiana Fever game is being nationalized this year. They are squeezing every drop of value out of the Caitlin Clark effect, while also dealing with a media landscape that is finally starting to treat the league with the same critical, accountability-focused reporting we see in men's sports. It's a sign of maturity. If you're getting roasted on the radio for a bad rotation, you've officially made it. The Professional Women's Hockey League is following a similar growth script. They're expanding into Detroit after using neutral site games to prove there's a real audience there. It's a smart, low-risk way to validate a market before you commit to a franchise. They're planning more events in Detroit this June, using actual ticket sales, not just projections, to lure in U.S. broadcasters. Finally, if you're looking at the NFL Coach of the Year betting markets, the data says you should ignore the actual coaching and follow the story. Historically, you need 12 wins and a 5-game improvement to win, but narrative usually beats math. That's why the Giants' John Harbaugh is getting buzz for cultural change, while Mike McCarthy is basically disqualified because he's already winning. It's a popularity contest disguised as a meritocracy. While leagues are trying to figure out their broadcast future, the publishing world is looking at a new way to monetize influence. James Murdoch is looking to buy New York Magazine and the Vox Media Podcast Network. The deal is valued at over $300 million. And would represent a massive strategic pivot for Murdoch's Lupa Systems. The goal here isn't just to own a legendary magazine or a bunch of successful podcasts. It's to use those brands as a foundation for a high-margin event business. Murdoch is reportedly eyeing a model where the journalism provides the scaffolding or the brand cachet, while the real money comes from what they're calling human gathering. Think of it as an event-centric business model, similar to what Jay Penske has built, but with a more ambitious, World Fair vibe. It's a bet that in a world drowning in digital content, the real value lies in the influence economy. Basically, charging people a lot of money to be in the same room as the people they hear on their AirPods. The economics of this are pretty blunt. New York Magazine's traditional publishing arm operates on thin margins, but the Vox Media Podcast Network is already generating substantial profits. Events, however, are the real prize. They offer even higher margins than digital ads or subscriptions. The idea is to take talent like Kara Swisher and Scott Galloway and use their audience draw to anchor large-scale, sophisticated gatherings that sit somewhere between a TED Talk and the Aspen Ideas Festival. Which honestly sounds like a nightmare for anyone who actually likes reading the magazine. But as a business move, it makes a cold kind of sense. If you can't make the math work on long-form features about the housing market, you sell tickets to a summit where people talk about the housing market. The journalism becomes the loss leader for the $5,000 ticket. There is a significant hurdle here, though. The market is getting crowded. The landscape is becoming oversaturated with high-profile events targeting C-suite executives. For this World Fair concept to work, Murdoch has to offer a unique value proposition that justifies the cost and the time for sponsors and attendees. It's not enough to just have a famous logo on the lanyard anymore. You actually have to create an experience that doesn't feel like a corporate retreat in a fancy hotel. This also marks James Murdoch's formal return to the media landscape on his own terms. After not inheriting the specific parts of the family empire he might have expected, this venture is being framed as a bid for a legacy independent of his father. He isn't just buying a hobby, he's trying to prove he can build a media company that actually functions in the 2020s. But there's a catch. For this to succeed, Murdoch has to care about the business health as much as the editorial prestige. He's going to need to delegate to strong leadership in both editorial and event planning because the scrutiny is going to be intense. Not just from his rivals in the media, but almost certainly from within his own family. It's one thing to buy a magazine because you want to be a mogul. It's another to actually make the World Fair of Podcasts a profitable reality. The risk, of course, is that the scaffolding, the actual reporting and writing, gets neglected in favor of the event planning. If the magazine loses its edge, the brand cachet that makes the events valuable disappears. It's a delicate balance, and Murdoch is betting $300 million that he can pull it off without breaking the very thing he's buying. We'll see if the influence economy has room for one more billionaire trying to throw the ultimate networking party. Of course, if you're an FPL manager, effort is usually synonymous with stressing over double game weeks. Game week 36 is here, and the focus is narrowed down to two teams with double fixtures, Manchester City and Crystal Palace. If you're looking at the standings, this is the week where the safe play and the Hail Mary play finally diverge. Manchester City is the clear priority. They have a home double against Brentford and Crystal Palace, and because they're in a dead heat for the title, the motivation is as high as it gets. Erling Haaland is being framed as the captaincy lock for this stretch, specifically as the prime candidate for the triple captainship. Behind him, City's Cherki is being flagged as the top midfield option despite a tough Brentford defense. It's pretty simple. City has the fixtures and the need to win, so you play them. Then there's Crystal Palace. This is where the reporting gets messy. On one hand, Palace has the double game week, which usually means bye. Some analysts are even suggesting an aggressive defensive triple up with goalkeeper Henderson and defenders like Lacava and Munoz. The logic there isn't clean sheets, it's save points and defensive actions against high-volume attacks. But there's a massive caveat here. Other reports are screaming trap. Palace is currently prioritizing their European final, which means heavy rotation is likely. They also have a brutal run, including City, Brentford, and Arsenal. Look, if a team is dreaming about a trophy in Europe, they aren't going to risk their stars' hamstrings for a mid-table league finish. Chasing Palace points right now feels like a gamble on whether their B team can survive a firing squad. Elsewhere, the move of the week appears to be dumping Cole Palmer. Despite his season, his recent form is inconsistent. And Chelsea's schedule, including a potential FA Cup final, is making him the primary sacrifice for managers who need to find cash. That money is flowing directly into Arsenal. Bukayo Saka is the main target here. Even though his minutes have been managed lately, his expected goal involvement remains high, and he's nearing full match fitness. If you're looking for a third Arsenal asset, William Saliba is the defensive pick, while Kai Havertz is a high upside option, though he carries some rotation risk. In the mid-range, keep an eye on Brighton and Bournemouth. There is a scenario where a sixth Champions League spot opens up for the Premier League if Aston Villa wins the Europa League. If that happens, teams sitting in 7th or 8th suddenly have a massive reason to care again. It's a nice reminder that in the final weeks, motivation matters as much as talent. Finally, for the bench boosters, the names to circle are Raya, Hinchwood, and Chris Wood. Wood, in particular, is facing a struggling Wolves defense and is being touted as a high-return forward for the run-in. Here's the reality. We're at the point of the season where vibes start to outweigh the spreadsheets. You can play the numbers and pick the guys with the double game weeks, or you can look at who actually has something to play for. Selling Palmer to get Saka feels like the smart, cold-blooded move, but triple-stacking Crystal Palace defenders, that sounds like a great way to ruin your Saturday morning. Use your head. Before we wrap things up, here are a few other stories that caught my eye. A few other things worth knowing before you head out. Angel Studios is basically trying to bypass the Hollywood gatekeepers by crowdsourcing their greenlight process. They've got a 2 million member guild that votes on what actually gets made, which is their way of proving that the industry's mainstream values are usually just executives talking to themselves in a mirror. It's a resilient business model, even if the movies themselves aren't exactly my cup of tea. There's a comedian named Ben Palmer who set up a fake immigration tip line, and the results are exactly as depressing as you'd expect. He uses a deadpan delivery to get people to report their neighbors for basically nothing, which exposes the casual xenophobia baked into a lot of these rule follower types. It's funny in a way that makes you want to stare into the middle distance for 20 minutes. And finally, if you want to understand American history, stop looking at the stuff in glass cases and start looking at the trash. We're talking bootleg t-shirts and the blueback spellers used by enslaved people to teach themselves to read. These objects tell a much messier, more revealing story. It's as close as we'll get to a history lesson that doesn't deserve to be pretty. More human story of who we are than any official monument ever could. Anyway, that's what's on the radar. I'll talk to you tomorrow.